He knew what would happen if he drank this spice drug with its quintessence of the substance that brought the change onto him. He would return to the vision of pure time, of time become space. It would perch him on the dizzying summit and defy him to understand. From behind Chani, Stilgar said, "Drink it, lad. You delay the rite." Paul listened to the crowd then, hearing the wildness in their voices.
"Lizan al-Gaib," they said. "Muad'Dib."
He looked down at his mother. She appeared peacefully asleep in a sitting position, her breathing even and deep. A phrase out of the future that was his lonely past came into his mind. "She sleeps in the waters of life." Chani tugged at his sleeve. Paul took the horn spout into his mouth, hearing the people shout. He felt the liquid gush into his throat as Chani pressed the sack, sensed giddiness in the fumes. Chani removed the spout, handed the sack into hands that reached for it from the floor of the cavern. His eyes focused on her arm, the green band of mourning there. As she straightened, Chani saw the direction of his gaze, said,
"I can mourn him, even in the happiness of the waters. This was something he gave us."
She put her hand into his, pulling him along the ledge.
"We are alike in a thing, Usul. We have each lost a father to the Harkonnens."
Paul followed her. He felt that his head had been separated from his body and restored with odd connections. His legs were remote and rubbery. They entered a narrow side passage, its walls dimly lighted by spaced-out glow-globes. Paul felt the drug beginning to have its unique effect on him, opening time like a flower. He found need to steady himself against Chani as they turned through another shadowed tunnel. The mixture of whipcord and softness he felt beneath her robe stirred his blood. The sensation mingled with the work of the drug, folding future and past into the present, leaving him the thinnest margin of trinocular focus.
"I know you, Chani," he whispered. "We've sat upon a ledge above the sand, while I soothed your fears. We've caressed in the dark of the siege. We've..."
He found himself losing focus, tried to shake his head, stumbled. Chani steadied him, led him through thick hangings into the yellow warmth of a private apartment. Low tables, cushions, a sleeping pad beneath an orange spread. Paul grew aware that they had stopped, that Chani stood facing him, and that her eyes betrayed a look of quiet terror.
"You must tell me," she whispered.
"You are Sihaya," he said, "the desert spring."
"When the tribe shares the water," she said, "we are together, all of us. We share. I can sense the others with me, but I'm afraid to share with you."
"Why?" He tried to focus on her, but past and future were merging into the present, blurring her image. He saw her in countless ways and positions and settings.
"There's something frightening in you," she said. "When I took you away from the others, I did it because I could feel what the others wanted. You press on people. You make us see things."
He forced himself to speak distinctly. "What do you see?" She looked down at her hands.
"I see a child in my arms. It's our child, yours and mine."
She put a hand to her mouth.
"How can I know every feature of you?"
"They've a little of the talent," his mind told him, "but they suppress it because it terrifies." In a moment of clarity, he saw how Chani was trembling. "What is it you want to say?" he asked.
"Usul," she whispered,
and still she trembled. "You cannot back into the future," he said. A profound compassion for her swept through him. He pulled her against him, stroked her head.
"Chani, Chani, don't fear." "Usul, help me," she cried.
As she spoke, he felt the drug complete its work within him, ripping away the curtains to let him see the distant gray turmoil of his future.
"You're so quiet," Chani said.
He held himself poised in the awareness, seeing time stretch out in its weird dimension, delicately balanced yet whirling, narrow yet spread like a net, gathering countless worlds and forces, a tight wire that he must walk, yet a teeter-totter on which he balanced. On one side he could see the Imperium, a Harkonnen called Fade Rotha, who flashed toward him like a deadly blade, the Sardaukar raging off their planet to spread pogrom on Arrakis, the Guild conniving and plotting, the Bene Gesserit with their scheme of selective breeding. They lay massed like a thunderhead on his horizon, held back by no more than the Fremen and their Muad'Dib, the sleeping giant Fremen poised for their wild crusade across the universe. Paul felt himself at the center, at the pivot where the whole structure turned, walking a thin wire of peace with a measure of happiness, Chani at his side. He could see it stretching ahead of him, a time of relative quiet in a hidden siege, a moment of peace between periods of violence. "There's no other place for peace," he said.
"Usul, you're crying," Chani murmured. "Usul, my strength, do you give moisture to the dead? To whose dead?"
"To ones not yet dead," he said.
"Then let them have their time of life," she said.
He sensed through the drug fog how right she was, pulled her against him with savage pressure.
"Sihaya," he said.
She put a palm against his cheek.
"I'm no longer afraid, Usul. Look at me. I see what you see when you hold me thus."
"What do you see?" he demanded.
"I see us giving love to each other in a time of quiet between storms. It's what we were meant to do."
The drug had him again, and he thought,
"So many times you've given me comfort and forgetfulness."
He felt anew the hyperillumination with its high-relief imagery of time, sensed his future becoming memories, the tender indignities of physical love, the sharing and communion of selves, the softness and the violence.
"You're the strong one, Chani," he muttered. "Stay with me." "Always," she said, and kissed his cheek.
Book 3. The Prophet.
No woman, no man, no child ever was deeply intimate with my father. The closest anyone ever came to casual camaraderie with the Padishah Emperor was the relationship offered by Count Hasimir Fenring, a companion from childhood. The measure of Count Fenring's friendship may be seen first in a positive thing. He allayed the Lansrod's suspicions after the Arrakis affair. It cost more than 1 billion solaris in spice bribes, so my mother said, and there were other gifts as well. Slave women, royal honors, and tokens of rank. The second major evidence of the Count's friendship was negative. He refused to kill a man, even though it was within his capabilities, and my father commanded it. I will relate this presently.
Count Fenring, A Profile, by the Princess Irulan. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen raged down the corridor from his private apartments, flitting through patches of late afternoon sunlight that poured down from high windows. He bobbed and twisted in his suspensors with violent movements. Past the private kitchen he stormed, past the library, past the small reception room, and into the servants' antechamber where the evening relaxation already had set in. The guard captain, Yakin Nafud, squatted on a divan across the chamber, the stupor of Samuta dullness in his flat face, the eerie wailing of Samuta music around him. His own court sat near to do his bidding.
"Nafud!" the baron roared.
Men scrambled. Nafud stood, his face composed by the narcotic, but with an overlay of paleness that told of his fear. The Samuta music had stopped.
"My lord baron?" Nafud said.
Only the drug kept the trembling out of his voice. The baron scanned the faces around him, seeing the looks of frantic quiet in them. He returned his attention to Nafud, and spoke in a silken tone.
"How long have you been my guard, Captain Nafud?"
Nafud swallowed.
"Since Arrakis, my lord. Almost 2 years."
"And have you always anticipated dangers to my person?"
"Such has been my only desire, my lord."
"Then where is Faed Rotha?"
the baron roared. Nafud recoiled.
"My lord?"
"You do not consider Faed Rotha a danger to my person?"
Again the voice was silken. Nafud wet his lips with his tongue. Some of the Samuta dullness left his eyes.
"Faed Rotha's in the slave quarters, my lord."
"With the women again, eh?"
The baron trembled with the effort of suppressing anger.
"Sire, it could be he's..."
"Silence!"
The baron advanced another step into the antechamber, noting how the men moved back, clearing a subtle space around Nafud, dissociating themselves from the object of wrath.
"Did I not command you to know precisely where the Na Baron was at all times?" the baron asked.
He moved a step closer.
"Did I not say to you that you were to know precisely what the Na Baron was saying at all times, and to whom?"
Another step.
"Did I not say to you that you were to tell me whenever he went into the quarters of the slave women?"
Nafud swallowed. Perspiration stood out on his forehead. The baron held his voice flat, almost devoid of emphasis.
"Did I not say these things to you?"
Nafud nodded.
"And did I not say to you that you were to check all slave boys sent to me, and that you were to do this yourself? Personally?"
Again Nafud nodded.
"Did you, perchance, not see the blemish on the thigh of the one sent me this evening?"
the baron asked.
"Is it possible you..."
"Uncle!"
The baron whirled, stared at Faed Rotha standing in the doorway.
the presence of his nephew here, now, the look of hurry that the young man could not quite conceal, all revealed much. Fade Rotha had his own spy system focused on the Baron.
"There is a body in my chambers that I wish removed," the Baron said,
and he kept his hand at the projectile weapon beneath his robes, thankful that his shield was the best. Fade Rotha glanced at two guardsmen against the right wall, nodded. The two detached themselves, scurried out the door and down the hall toward the Baron's apartments.
"Those two, eh?" the Baron thought. "Ah, this young monster has much to learn yet about conspiracy." "I presume you left matters peaceful in the slave quarters, Fade?" the Baron said.
"I've been playing Cheops with the slave master," Fade Rotha said, and he thought, "What has gone wrong? The boy we sent to my uncle has obviously been killed, but he was perfect for the job. Even Howitt couldn't have made a better choice. The boy was perfect."
"Playing pyramid chess," the Baron said. "How nice. Did you win?"
Yes, Uncle."
And Fade Rotha strove to contain his disquiet. The Baron snapped his fingers.
"Nefood, you wish to be restored to my good graces?"
"Sire, what have I done?" Nefood quavered.
"That's unimportant now," the Baron said. "Fade has beaten the slave master at Cheops. Did you hear that?"
"Yes, sire."
"I wish you to take three men and go to the slave master," the Baron said. "Garrot, the slave master. Bring his body to me when you've finished, that I may see it was done properly. We cannot have such inept chess players in our employ."
Fade Rotha went pale, took a step forward.
"But, Uncle, I—"
"Later, Fade," the Baron said, and waved a hand. "Later."
The two guards who had gone to the Baron's quarters for the slave boy's body staggered past the antechamber door with their load sagging between them, arms trailing. The Baron watched until they were out of sight. Nefood stepped up beside the Baron.
"You wish me to kill the slave master now, my lord?"
"Now," the Baron said. "And when you've finished, add those two who just passed to your list. I don't like the way they carried that body. One should do such things neatly. I'll wish to see their carcasses, too."
Nefood said,
"My lord, is it anything that I—"
"Do as your master has ordered," Fade Rotha said,
and he thought, "All I can hope for now is to save my own skin."
"Good," the Baron thought. "He yet knows how to cut his losses."
And the Baron smiled inwardly at himself, thinking,
"The lad knows, too, what will please me, and be most apt to stay my wrath from falling on him. He knows I must preserve him. Who else do I have who could take the reins I must leave some day? I have no other as capable. But he must learn, and I must preserve myself while he's learning."
Nefood signaled men to assist him, led them out the door.
"Would you accompany me to my chambers, Fade?" the Baron asked.
"I am yours to command," Fade Rotha said.
He bowed, thinking, "I'm caught."
"After you," the Baron said,
and he gestured to the door. Fade Rotha indicated his fear by only the barest hesitation.
"Have I failed utterly?" he asked himself. "Will he slip a poisoned blade into my back, slowly, through the shield? Does he have an alternative successor?"
"Let him experience this moment of terror," the Baron thought as he walked along behind his nephew. "He will succeed me, but at a time of my choosing. I'll not have him throwing away what I've built."
Fade Rotha tried not to walk too swiftly. He felt the skin crawling on his back as though his body itself wondered when the blow would come. His muscles alternately tensed and relaxed.
"Have you heard the latest word from Arrakis?" the Baron asked.
"No, Uncle."
Fade Rotha forced himself not to look back. He turned down the hall out of the servants' wing.
"They've a new prophet or religious leader of some kind among the Fremen," the Baron said. "They call him Muad'Dib. Very funny, really. It means the mouse,